From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. On this 19th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks, the presidential candidates, their running mates, and their spouses are attending remembrances for the nearly 3,000 people who died. This morning, President Trump spoke in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where one of the planes hijacked on 9/11 crashed after passengers fought to take it back.
The heroes of Flight 93 are an everlasting reminder that no matter the danger, no matter the threat, no matter the odds, America will always rise up, stand tall, and fight back.
Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Joining us today, Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large of The 19th. That's a newsroom focusing on gender, politics, and policy. And Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter at NBC. Welcome to both of you. Sahil, it has been 19 years since 9/11. Are you surprised by how little terrorism and national security have figured into the campaign so far this year?
It's great to be back. I'm not surprised that foreign policy isn't a major issue in the election, for the main reason that when the economy is weak, when there is a recession, that tends to be the biggest thing on the minds of voters. Now we have that and a massive deadly pandemic that's been sweeping through the nation and the world that has killed over 190,000 Americans. So it doesn't surprise me that foreign policy doesn't, that foreign policy isn't on the isn't high on the list of voter concerns. And we see that reflected on the campaign trail. It simply isn't a focal point of issues discussed by either President Trump or Joe Biden.
Aaron, though, on the issue of foreign policy, I think Sahil's absolutely right. It's not a main focus for most people. But what about for members of the military? This week, President Trump announced that he was reducing the number of U.S. troops still left in Iraq from 5,200 to 3,500. He has been campaigning on ending endless wars. And of course, he was in the news recently for his reported comments calling fallen soldiers losers and suckers. In terms of members of the military, is their support going to be critical in this election?
The military has been front and center in this election, even as 9/11 and issues of kind of terrorism foreign security have not necessarily been at the forefront. But I think that, issues from, whether we're talking about violence against women in the military or the president's recent comments, about the military, those reports have absolutely factored into how military veterans, service members, and their family are thinking about how they want to vote. And I think that both campaigns are aware of this. Joe Biden certainly has been talking about his support for the military as well as he's been out on the campaign trail. But, I think I'm struck, honestly, 19 years after 9/11, this anniversary is just another reminder of how divided we are as a country, particularly in this pandemic. When we, started back in March, it was a message of we're all in this together. And now we're wondering, whether masks are political and if our neighbors actually care about our health and safety. It really is just kind of putting back on the radar how our politics couldn't be more polarized and questions of who gets to be an American are raised every day.
Sahil, on that point of the coronavirus, for 2 days now, President Trump has tried to push back on the news in Bob Woodward's new book that he, the president, knew how deadly the coronavirus was back in February and that he wanted to downplay the dangers in public, he says, because he didn't want to panic people. Your thoughts on the revelations this week? This is a president who regularly uses fear to motivate people, and now he's saying, well, he didn't want to scare people. What do you make of all that?
These are legitimately painful revelations for President Trump because they show him on audio saying something very different privately than he was saying publicly. Privately, he knew that this was a deadly virus, that it was much worse than the flu, and that it was going to be very, very tricky to deal with. Publicly, he was downplaying it. He was comparing it to the flu. And he even says that he was actively trying to downplay it. Now, why was he doing that? He claims it's because he didn't want to stoke panic. That is a little odd to hear from a president who regularly stokes panic as part of his political brand and often does it, in an attempt to gain political support. And the examples of that include we can see them just now. He's making, you know, dramatized claims such as the suburbs will be abolished if he's defeated. No real evidence for that. He's claiming that the election would be rigged because of mail-in ballots rising substantially this year. Experts say there's no evidence for that. And it's also a dangerous claim because it could undermine faith in the election. He's talked in the past about Latin American refugees being actually gang members overrunning the border. So this is not a president who steers clear of stoking panic and the notion that he would be doing that on the coronavirus. I'm skeptical that voters will buy that. He ranks underwater on his approval of his, you know, handling of the coronavirus by an average of about 15 points in the polls. This is his single biggest vulnerability heading into the election.
Aaron, what do you think? Are the American people incapable of handling the truth about the coronavirus?
No. And in fact, you're seeing so many people saying that they would have appreciated, you know, knowing the gravity and the seriousness of you know, the coronavirus, you know, sounding the alarm or, you know, scaring the American people is not the same as informing the American people. And what we know, I mean, this was not just downplaying the pandemic. It was misleading because there were two very disparate messages we know now between what President Trump was saying at the podium and what he was saying privately to Bob Woodward. And for the Biden campaign, I think we're seeing that this is underscoring their message that this election is a referendum on President Trump, who they are saying has failed to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. You saw the Biden campaign immediately cutting an ad featuring the president's remarks, and they have been on the campaign trail reinforcing the idea that the president lied to the public and has been derelict in his duty in their casting of this to protect Americans. You know, to Sahil's point, it is disingenuous for the president to continue to spin this and say that he didn't want to alarm people, because it is curious that he would say that, you know, about a public health crisis, but somehow rioting and looting happening during overwhelmingly peaceful protests or the specter of non-existent voter fraud or the disappearance of the suburbs are worthy of alarm in this campaign season.
You know, we're talking all about the presidential election, which, of course, makes sense because it's coming up in 7.5 weeks. But there are politics going on right now that affect people right now. And I'm thinking of pandemic relief. The Congress, yes, has not been able to reach a deal on this. Republican senators failed to pass their so-called skinny pandemic relief package this week. There are, you know, millions of Americans who are unemployed, no fault of their own, and they don't have the extra money coming in to make ends meet. Aaron, is it really possible that Congress is going to allow the next couple of months to go by before the election and not pass anything to help people?
And not only is it possible, but it is looking likely in this continuously polarized Congress that can't seem to find a solution even in the midst of a pandemic that is affecting everybody. I mean, this the fact that they could not come up with a deal is striking, given that this really is about those of us who are living with coronavirus, right? The tens of millions of Americans who are affected by this pandemic, whether they or anyone they know ever gets sick or not. You know, the recovery around this economy is tenuous, fragile, or just simply not happening for millions of Americans. And that was something that was really kind of brought into sharp relief this week. You know, coming out of Labor Day, you had millions of parents, children, and staff at schools across the country who returned to class either virtually or in person. You know, people are looking for their elected officials to respond to this pandemic. That includes members of Congress. The unemployment numbers were unchanged from a week ago. You know, part of those pre-pandemic claims, the increase in that could be parents who can't go back to work because schools are closed.
Sahil, you know, speaking of money, there are reports coming out that the Trump campaign is running out of money, that they pulled in $150 million less in the month of August than the Biden campaign did. What do you read into all that?
Well, the Trump campaign raised $210 million in August, which is far behind Joe Biden's sum of $365 million raised in the same month. And I think that's one of the reasons we see a mismatch of on-air activity between the two campaigns. Joe Biden's campaign is outspending Trump on TV ads in key swing states like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Florida, states that President Trump really needs to win if he's going to secure another 4 years. These are the states that are probably going to decide who the next president is. And I think we can read into this that if you're a Democrat, running against President Trump is a pretty good fundraising pitch. And Joe Biden has been very successful at raising money as part of his message that wherever you are, wherever you stand on the issues, whatever your ideology is, first thing that Democrats need to do is get President Trump out of office.
That is Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter at NBC, and Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large of The 19th. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Deadly wildfires continue to rage in the western United States. More than 500,000 acres have burned so far in Washington state since Labor Day. High winds and temperatures have created perfect conditions for fast, destructive firestorms. Ashley Ahern headed to Bridgeport, Washington, where the Cold Springs fire has scorched hundreds of thousands of acres and is still threatening homes and wildlife.
There's a tree smoking in the front yard. Generator running nearby because there's no power in town. I can see the chimney, just the scorched out car parked in the driveway, the tractor. Everything's black. Hillsides all around are black. And this is one of 12 homes that have been destroyed in this community of Bridgeport, right along the Columbia River. There's a trailer burned out across the street. I'm gonna go try to talk to these folks.
Hi, my name is Ashley. Is this your house?
Yes. Yeah, this is my parents' house that was affected.
Elizabeth
Hildo
is standing outside the burned out shell of her parents' trailer home on the outskirts of town. Her father and mother came here from Mexico almost 20 years ago. Elizabeth tells me her father picks cherries and apples for the local fruit industry and saved up for years to buy this home. They'd only owned it for 1 year.
They've always wanted the best for us, you know, and their family, and coming here was like trying to get like the American dream, you know, is what it means for them. Trying to get better, you know, and they worked here so hard. And when they finally were able to afford a house, it just burns down, yeah.
Elizabeth and her family go back to picking up burned debris, and I drive a few blocks over to meet up with Michael Schroeder and learn about another loss from this fire. Schroeder has been studying sage grouse with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife for almost 30 years. The bird is threatened in Washington state. There are fewer than 1,000 of them left, and many of them live, or lived, right in this area. Schroeder evacuated when the fire came through and hasn't had power or water at his house for a few days, along with all of his neighbors. But he seems more concerned about the sage grouse right now.
I've been driving around for the last 24 hours checking out some of the damage, and it's just devastating. Washington state, from a personal perspective and from a grouse perspective, has been devastated. This has been a fire for the century.
We drive out of town through miles of blackened hillsides, scorched power poles, twisted guardrails, and sagebrush skeletons to a place Schroeder knows well.
You want to do it? It's your dime. I haven't been up here today.
Okay.
I will bring my camera because...
We walk along a burned-out barbed wire fence and up a small hill that gives us a view for miles around. And it's all black, where there used to be healthy native sagebrush and sage grouse. This spot was home to one of the biggest remaining leks, or mating sites, for sage grouse in the state.
And it's right in the middle of oblivion, or Mordor, as somebody referred to it. From the Lord of the Rings.
Schroeder's been studying this lek for decades, coming back each year to count the birds and see how the population is doing. And he's watched it decline steadily over the decades. He held out hope that the bird would keep hanging on. But as he stands on this hilltop looking out over miles of blackened earth in every direction, he's worried that the birds won't recover from this.
If it was just this, but it isn't just this. It's like you go over to that hill and it looks the same. You go over there, it looks the same.
His voice breaks and trails off as he turns and gestures around us.
There's no way.
More than 300,000 acres in this part of eastern Washington have burned, destroying the habitat of hundreds of species, including endangered pygmy rabbit and sharp-tailed grouse. The fires are still burning. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Ahern in Bridgeport, Washington.
And yes, of course, the wildlife is suffering in these western fires, but they've also taken a tremendous toll on people. At least 14 people have died across three states. And in California, the Creek Fire in the Sierra National Forest has forced 45,000 residents to evacuate over the past week. Some of the very first to leave their homes were in the tiny town of Big Creek, California. Toby Waite joins us now. He's a Big Creek resident and the principal of the local elementary school. Toby, I know you've just lost your home. I'm so sorry to be talking to you under these circumstances, but can you just tell me what happened as that fire approached and you were evacuated?
Yeah, no, certainly. You know, the fire started Friday evening, and it was just a little smoke chimney. But as the night grew on, embers started to fly. Early Saturday morning, the volunteer fire department and the county sheriff department came through and informed us that we had to evacuate. To evacuate out of town, there's one road in, essentially one road out, and it's 4 miles straight uphill cut into the side of a cliff. So as we were evacuating at 4:30 in the morning, we had a caravan of 50 to 60 cars. Residents were pulling trailers and boats out of Big Creek, and we're going up this one-lane road, praying that equipment would not be coming down the road to fight the fire.
That was about a week ago. You've been in Fresno with family since then, but I understand also you just got back into town to see the destruction. I mean, what does it look like? What's left of Big Creek?
Half our town is gone. It is certainly gut-wrenching to go back, but that is our new reality. And, you know, and I've told my families that have lost their homes, you know, we are not going to become victims of this fire. We are going to rise above it. And, you know, when I look back at Big Creek, is it terrible? Absolutely. It will be months before we are allowed back in. And to understand Big Creek, it truly is a community. I call it Mayberry. It's a throwback to the 50s. And it's just this truly incredible community. We've lost so much. It's devastating. We are going to need a lot of assistance moving forward. However, we're going to stay positive. We're going to rise. And we're truly a blessed community.
Toby, I admire your optimism. I truly do. How do you do that? How do you feel that way when you go back to your home and you see it in ashes?
It's all about attitude. We all need that grieving period to look at where our home stood, where our children grew up. But we also have to look to the future. What we make of that new reality is completely up to us.
But what about this school year? I mean, as if 2020 wasn't hard enough, you know, what's ahead for the school year, for your kids, for the teachers, for...
That is such a great question. We were going to have our waiver to return back to in-person instruction this week. And of course, that has changed. So we're starting distance learning on Monday. We are out delivering new computers, laptops, and Chromebooks to our students today who left them, either we lost them to the fire or when they evacuated, they left them at home. School starts Monday morning, 8:30. We are going to get back after it. We have to.
You expect people to be there, ready to go.
I expect them to be there, ready to go. And I think for kids, they need to get back to their normal routines. The last 6 months have been incredibly difficult. We cannot let, you know, a coronavirus, a fire affect our future.
You say half the town is gone. What Correct. About the people? I mean, it must be miraculous. You described the evacuation. Are you surprised that with the destruction of this fire that nobody's died?
It is. I'm surprised the whole town is not gone. The fire, as we saw it coming and from the photographs, tell you what, the men and women, firefighters, did just an incredible job. And, you know, today being 9/11, I reflect on this as we saw the images of New York City as people were fleeing, fire personnel were going into these buildings. As we were fleeing Big Creek, people were coming in. They do not know us, yet here they are coming in, putting their lives on the line to save a home, a house. It just blows my mind. And we have a lot of big asks coming up on how people can support us. This is a marathon, and we haven't even started the race. We're not even to the start line yet.
Toby, to that point, people like me are just sort of helplessly watching from afar as we, you know, hear stories from people like you, as we see images of an orange, ominous sky in San Francisco, you know, California, Oregon, Washington, all burning. You're living this firsthand. You know, what's your message to the rest of us?
Well, to the rest of us, we want to look at and say this is climate change or this is global warming. Are those two? Yes, I believe in global warming. Yes, I believe in climate change. But at the end of the day, this is lack of management. Southern California Edison, which we are a company town, when you get to the Edison land, it is pristine. It is beautiful. It is still there. The fire went around Edison land, and it burnt everything else, publicly managed lands. And I really think, how do we get through this, and how do we avoid people having to experience this again, is to really begin to have this conversation of following science. You know, with the COVID pandemic, it's preached to us, listen to the science. And I think when it comes to our national forests, we have to listen to the science. These are not climate fires. These are lack of human intervention fires.
Toby Waite lost his home to the Creek Fire in Big Creek, California. Toby, I'm sorry. Best of luck to you as you try to get this school year underway. We appreciate your time.
I appreciate it and helping to share our story. Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Wednesday, September 16th, from 9 to 10 a.m., sdm.mit.edu.
The state of Florida plans to allow bars to reopen at 50% capacity starting on Monday. They had been ordered shut down for more than 2 months after a spike in coronavirus cases in June. The Kaiser Family Foundation reports Florida is one of 16 states that currently have bars closed due to the pandemic, and several others still have some restrictions in place. Joining us now is Danielle Pryor, reporter with WMFE in Orlando. Danielle, why does Florida's governor want to reopen the bars right now?
I think it's that there's been some outbreaks tied to bars, but not a lot of kind of very big significant ones recently. We're seeing a drop in hospitalizations here, a drop in cases, a drop in deaths, and I think just looking at the economy, we know that our tourism and our hospitality industries have been so hard hit here. The bars are just a crucial part of that, Jeremy. And so the idea is opening those up will not only encourage maybe some local tourism from other parts of Florida, but will help those people who depend on those jobs as bartenders for a living, whether those are first-time jobs or veterans of those industries that have just been so hard hit the last 6 months.
Will the reopening be different this time around than it was the last time? Because last time they had to shut back down because people weren't complying with the guidelines.
Yeah, this time around it'll be 50% capacity right out the door. And then also people will need to be seated to be served indoors. There'll be limited outdoor seating, but it'll have to observe all of those social distancing rules that we've all been practicing. And bars have to prove that they are kind of following these phase two protocols, otherwise they'll be shut right back down again.
What are the concerns at this point? Because we've heard Dr. Fauci, the leading infectious disease specialist, talk about how bars are a real problem because people move around and maybe they get a little inebriated and then they really don't follow the guidelines that they're supposed to be following.
We've already seen that here, Jeremy, actually, in Orlando. We've seen bars on local college campuses that have been shut down for that exact reason, some in downtown Orlando. And we have seen outbreaks as of June tied to bar situations that were just unsafe. And so I think health officials are worried. We've seen kind of over 200 deaths the last few days here. And so obviously we don't want to see those numbers go up. We've reopened schools here as well. So there's already a chance that we're going to see a bump in cases. So we don't want to see another bump from this as well.
Yeah, when you look at the graph for the state of Florida, it looks much better now. The slope is coming down, but as you said, still a couple hundred deaths in the last few days, and I think 2,500 new cases just yesterday.
That's right. We definitely haven't beaten it here yet. And, you know, the governor said yesterday that he's planning on lifting restrictions for restaurants, putting those at 100% capacity. Hmm. Already talking about eventually, you know, that emergency order statewide, that's going to have to be lifted soon as well. I think he's looking at the economy as well as those numbers, although he's mostly looking at those hospitalizations, which, again, are down. But if you look at jobs, we've been incredibly hard hit in this state. Again, we rely on the tourism and the hospitality industry, and people mm-hmm. just aren't coming to Florida the way that they were before. So I think the idea is slowly and trying to safely reopen things so that people are safe health-wise, but also, you know, they have a job to go to. And, you know, we have a real problem here with affordable housing as it is. We don't want to have a homelessness crisis on our hands.
That is Danielle Pryor, reporter with WMFE in Orlando. Danielle, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Sophia B. Otto.
Lee Adler.
Today marks 19 years since the 9/11 terrorist attacks, a day that changed the world forever. On that day, Brian Clark was an executive at Eurobrokers working on the 84th floor of two World Trade Center. He was one of the few who were able to escape from a floor above where the plane struck the building. On the way down, Brian stopped to help another man, Stanley Pramnath, who was trapped in rubble on the 81st floor. The two made it out of the building just minutes before it collapsed. I spoke with Brian Clark in 2016, and I asked him, even though he'd probably been asked 1,000 times before, to tell us what happened to him that day.
I arrived at my office about 7:15, which is normal time on a beautiful blue sky day. And I was sitting at my desk, and at 8:46, there was a loud boom, boom, and my head jerked up as the light sort of flashed, and my peripheral vision caught something behind me, and 84 floors in the air was flames right against the glass. It dissipated after about 3 seconds, and out in the airspace was singed newspapers and computer sheets and so on, just sort of floating in the air. Very strange. I thought something had happened a couple of floors above me, maybe a welder on a construction site, had hit a gas line, something like that. I had also been in the Trade Center in 1993 and had volunteered to be one of our floor's fire safety marshals. And they had provided a flashlight and a whistle and given us some training in the intervening years. They'd done actually a very good job of that, in my opinion. So I grabbed the flashlight, put the whistle around my neck, went out of my office and started moving the people in my quadrant, as I was instructed, to the center core to await further instructions. So people started to move. The brokers on the east side of our tower rushed to the north windows and looked up 9 floors to the 93rd floor of the north tower and saw a ring of fire around that floor. So we knew very quickly that something had happened next door, that it wasn't our building, in fact. I walked to those windows and had heard that people had started to jump. I didn't want to see that, so I stayed back from the windows, went back to my office, called my wife in Mahwah. I called my dad in Toronto, told them, turn on the TV, something's happened next door, but we are okay. I put down the phone, and the strobe lights flashed. The speaker gave a little whoop whoop, and a voice came upon the PA system and said, your attention, please, ladies and gentlemen, Building 2, the South Tower, is secure. If you're in the midst of evacuation, you may use the re-entry doors and the elevators to return to your floor. Repeat, Building 2 is secure. And he went through the instruction again.
And this is just minutes before, by the way, the other plane hit your tower, correct?
That is correct. I came out of my office and came nose to nose with a coworker of mine, Bobby Call. And I said, Bobby, what have you heard? He said, well, I was down a few floors and I heard the announcement and I came back up. And he was in the midst of that sentence when boom, boom, this loud double explosion again. And it was really, I didn't know it at the time, but it was our building being hit and then the plane exploding inside. It came in at about the 78th, 79th floor, 6 floors below us. And in that split second of the double explosion, our floor just fell apart. Everything came out of the ceiling, air conditioning ducts and speakers and the works, if you like, fell down. No electricity. The air was filled with white, chalky construction dust. There was no flames, no smoke at that point. And the building swayed. For 10 seconds, I was terrified. And that, fortunately for me, in hindsight, that was the only moment of the day that I was afraid. For 5 seconds, the building swayed toward the west, toward the Hudson River. And whether this really happened or not, I can't say with certainty, but the sensation was, and this will sound like an exaggeration, but I'm telling you what I felt, the building swayed 6 to 8 feet. And then it stopped, and then for 5 seconds it came back to vertical, and with a noticeable sort of hop or jerk as all the steel went into square, it you know, came back to vertical, and I had this feeling wash over me, Brian, you'll be okay. And for the rest of the day, I felt like I was in control of what I was doing.
So how did you get out of the building before it collapsed? Tell us about that.
I led a group of 6 or 8 people into the center core with my flashlight on, and as I was approaching the intersection, you got to imagine these two hallways crossing, an east-west hallway, a north-south hallway, crossed in the middle of the building. As I approached the intersection, I had a choice to turn right to stairway C, go straight ahead to stairway B, or turn left to stairway A. I was intending to go to stairway C, and I felt this almost push on my left shoulder. It was a very strange feeling, but there was nobody there. But it pushed me to the left, and I started down stairway A. I just sort of went with it. And with these 6 or 8 people following me down the stairs in the darkness with my flashlight on, we only went down 3 floors when a heavy-set woman coming up the stairs stopped us. And she said, no, you can't go down. There's flames and smoke below. We've got to go higher. And she just refused to let anybody past her. And I was distracted in the midst of this conversation by a stranger's voice inside the 81st floor. I grabbed the shoulder of the fellow beside me, a coworker, Ron D. Francesco, and I said, Ron, we got to get this guy. And I don't think Ron knew what I was talking about, but we were able to push the drywall back and sort of squeeze between the door frame, the door was locked, between the door frame and the wall. We got Sid sideways through that. And I have this clear memory of everybody being on the floor of the landing, if you like, with me, and they all climbed higher, and sadly, they all died that day. Mm. But Ron and I went in on 81, and halfway to the stranger, Ron was overcome with the smoke, and he went back to the stairs. I continued on to this stranger, kind of dug him out of the rubble, and the two of us went back to the stairway, and I guess that was the fateful moment. I shone the light down the stairs. I only saw smoke billowing up, not any flames, and we just started down. We dug our way through a lot of rubble and got out of the building at about 4 minutes to 10.
Down 80 floors of stairs at that point.
Correct.
Wow.
We ran south from the Trade Center, got to Trinity Church when my new best friend Stanley from Fuji Bank turned around and said, I think that building's going to come down. I said, I don't think so. That's a steel structure. That's carpets and furniture and drapery burning. And I didn't really finish that sentence when boom, 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 from the top, this whole building dissolved in 8 to 10 seconds. Mm. And we watched the South Tower collapse. Trinity Church acted as protection at that time because the white wave of guck slammed into Trinity Church like a wave hitting a seawall, and it exploded upward, and Stanley and I are standing in this big bubble of fresh air. We ran up to Broadway, and when the wave caught up to us, we dove into 42 Broadway, a building I'd never been in before, and we talked for 45 minutes. During that time, the North Tower collapsed. We didn't know that. We went out the back side of 42 Broadway onto Broad Street by the New York Stock Exchange, and somehow we got separated. But I wandered over to the East River. As I started walking north, I heard a bullhorn, next ferries for Jersey City. Well, I want to get to New Jersey. I ran down that pier, jumped on a ferry, and it went down the East River and around Battery Park and Wow. Northwest toward Jersey City.
So, first of all, do you still keep in touch with Stanley?
Stanley and I are good friends. I went to his oldest daughter's wedding about a month ago. He, several years ago, came to one of my daughter's weddings. One of us calls the other one every couple of months, and we're blood brothers at this point.
Yeah.
It's an amazing relationship.
And 15 years later, how important is that experience in your life?
As I reflect back on the events of that day, what I've realized over time is that there's no point in dwelling on unanswerable questions. You know, what if I'd turned to the right to stairway C instead of going left, going with the push to stairway A? Likewise, one cannot predict the future with any certainty. Hmm. And so if you don't dwell on unanswerable questions in the past, you don't worry about the future, it pretty well leaves you with the present. And that's where I try to live every day. Every day is a great day. Some are just greater than others. Life is precious. You know, use every day to your best.
Brian Clark, who escaped from the 84th floor of 2 World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. We spoke in 2016, and Brian mentioned two colleagues, Ron DeFrancesco, who made it out of the World Trade Center. Bobby Call did not.
Janet Marie Alonzo.
Anthony Alvarado.
On August 27th, Joseph Griffin was jogging in his mostly white neighborhood of Deltona, Florida. Sheriff's deputies were also there, looking for someone who'd stolen a leaf blower. Griffin sort of fit the suspect's description, a black man wearing a tank top, dark shorts. So a Volusia County deputy stopped him.
You're not in any trouble or anything? There is a burglary that happened. You kind of fit the description. Let me just make sure that you're not him, okay?
That sound is from the deputy's body camera, but what happened next does not follow the narrative that we've grown accustomed to. Griffin was released and cleared, and now the department has asked him to help train officers to prevent bias. Joseph Griffin joins us now on Skype. Joseph, welcome. It's good to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
And can you take us back to that day? Here you are just jogging, and then all of a sudden you find yourself in handcuffs. What were you thinking at that point?
So at that point, definitely a lot of confusion going on. I actually, when the officer pulled up, I thought he was like saying like, hey, good job for running. I think I waved at him and kept going. So it was definitely confusing. He got out of the car and was like, hey, you know, he explained to me the situation. And at that point, I just wanted to remain compliant as I could so I could be able to go home to my newborn daughter.
Hmm. You're an Army veteran. You work as a nurse manager in an ICU. I'm sure you've been paying close attention to the things that have been happening in this country in terms of the fight for racial justice. You've seen a lot. Did you feel at that point like you were in danger?
It was definitely a scary moment with everything going on in the media, as you just said. So that's why I went on Facebook Live. It helped me feel a lot more comfortable if my family and friends were watching.
At the time, did you feel like the officers had done anything wrong, that they'd actually profiled you and shouldn't have detained you at all?
They didn't do anything that was illegal necessarily, but just some things that I wouldn't agree with, especially the cuffing. I wasn't going to run away. I feel like they could have just talked to me. And with the nature of the crime being just a stolen leaf blower, I didn't think it was that serious for the 9 cop cars and the cuffing.
It's interesting. At one point, you tell the officer that you're streaming this interaction live. He responds by actually helping you keep the phone running and even holds it for you at a certain point. And you told a local TV station in Orlando that, in your opinion, if a person remains calm with police, that the situation will go their way about 85% of the time. I want to ask you about that. A lot of people do stay calm in these types of interactions, and they still get shot. They still get hurt by the police. Yeah, you know, what about that? Is it really your responsibility to stay calm more than the officers?
No, it's definitely both parties play a big role. And in this situation, the officer did do a lot of things that were very helpful, such as streaming the live, and he constantly assured me that he wasn't going to let anything happen to me. As far as civilians being compliant, it does play a pretty decent sized role. And yes, we've seen multiple videos where, you know, the wrong thing happened even when people were compliant. And that is when the officers do have to answer for what they do. But overall, when you do remain compliant, I feel that if I wasn't compliant, that situation could have gone much more differently.
So you're released, as we say. Your video that you were streaming gets a lot of attention online. At some point, the police are actually calling you to thank you for what you did. And then they offer you a job and ask you to do anti-bias training with officers. Tell me about what your plan is for that. How are you going to approach doing that?
So I won't be taking the job as an officer, but I will be attending the racial bias training. I'll be partnering up with someone else who actually does the training. I think that this is very beneficial for America because we have a video of something kind of, yeah, it's a frustrating situation, but it kind of turned out in a positive way. And so if this could help the relationship between the community and officers, even if it's only a few, you know, anything that could help is definitely much needed in this society today.
And what will you say when you're in front of those police officers and doing this training with them? What's your message to them?
So my overall message is empathy and sympathizing for the person that you do have in cuffs. When you have that authority, sometimes it can get to your head and you kind of come off as having an attitude. But when you have some sympathy, you put yourself in the other person's shoes and honestly treat them as if they're innocent until proven guilty and not the other way around, it kind of goes a long way.
I hate to be skeptical, but I do want to ask you, do you think it'll make a difference and actually change any of the police policies that are at the root of this problem in America?
Now, I won't say it'll make anything perfect, but I've already seen some changes. I've been reached out to by officers in other departments and other counties, actually. I was even told by Sheriff Chitwood that, you know, initially he didn't even like the idea of the live video. But now that he sees that it kind of makes the other person on the other side feel comfortable, he was all for it. So, I mean, that's a big change in a sense. How often do officers actually hold the live video and start recording for you?
That's Joseph Griffin, who was detained while jogging in Volusia County, Florida, and is now working with the Sheriff's Department there on anti-bias training. Joseph, thanks very much for joining us, sharing your story.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.